Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Attractions Group podcast. This is episode 84. Alongside Don Helbig, I'm Ryan Sir. Don, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Ryan. It's hard to believe that we're, you know, now up to episode number 84. Mid-March already. How about that?
I know. It's the weather's getting warm here and everything. Hey, before we get started, because we do have a very special guest, make sure that you follow us on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple, Google, Spotify, you know the drill. Smash that subscribe button on YouTube and follow us on X/Twitter at @attractions_GRP. Don, what do we have going on today?
Now get ready. Here we go.
Super excited about our guest on this episode. It's one of my favorite YouTube channels out there. And by the time we get done with our guest, you're going to want to subscribe to his channel. I'd like to welcome Ryan the Mechanic. Ryan, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Yeah, and this is Ryan the Ride Mechanic's first ever appearance on a podcast. I didn't know that, but we're very honored that you chose us. So, Ryan, you know, let's start from the ground up. So what was your Sure. background before you came into the industry, before you became a ride mechanic?
So my background before I became a ride mechanic was I was working on cars in an auto body shop. And basically I was doing helping repair body work, that sort of stuff. I was kind of not officially like the body guy, but I was like helper. At the same time, the guy who ran the body shop was also a good friend of mine that I raced stock cars with. So we would work Monday through Friday, and then Saturday we would both show up at the racetrack and go out there and race stock cars on Saturday night. So then we would come back, and we grew together, had a good relationship, but that kind of got me like all these little things that I never knew that I needed, welding, fabrication, all these things like that, because I built my own stock cars as well. So that put me in a very unique spot. I have all these weird skills. Wasn't sure how to put those together. So that was before the industry. So if you want me to move on from there, basically what happened is that I needed a change because that job wasn't paying enough. So I was looking for another job, and I've always loved roller coasters, rides. I went to amusement parks as much as I could as a kid growing up. Like, I always wanted to be around them, touch them, work on them, everything. So one day I was out, I just started applying for jobs at amusement parks because I wanted to be a ride mechanic. Not sure if anyone would take me, just a body shop guy with race car experience. So I just threw my name out there, and interestingly enough, one park called me back, and not only they called me back, they brought me in for an interview because of my racing experience. Actually, the manager at the time raced trucks as well. So racing's a tight-knit community. So they brought me in, and it was funny. I've made videos about this, but one of the things that sold it is that once I was done doing the interview, which I don't honestly think I did that well on at the time, I went and said, can I walk through the shop? And they said, oh yeah, sure, let's go. And we started walking through stuff, and I was walking around, and I was just jaw on the floor looking at these. They had two trains in the shop being torn apart and built. And, you know, this was just like a wild fantasy of mine that has come true. It's like, this is amazing. And then I asked them so many questions. They could tell, and I was told afterwards, they said they knew I was just genuinely interested in it. And that, and I tell people this today too, the genuine interest and wanting to do something will get you way further than a lot of book smarts or anything else will in that industry. Just the drive to do it. So they took a chance, they hired me, and it paid off. I mean, I spent 14 years straight doing it, worked my way up from a mechanic to a lead to a supervisor. And then I left at a supervisory level, but, I've definitely had the capability to go higher. In fact, other parks have contacted me and said, hey, if you want to come in at doing something like this, we want to talk if you want to do that. And I declined from that time.
Yeah, Ryan, it seems to me that, you know, it's my experience in the industry is that a lot of the maintenance guys, you know, and now women, they had, you know, auto mechanics. It was a good way to transition into the industry. It seemed to work very well. But when you got into it, What were your expectations?
I honestly really wasn't sure what to expect because unlike what I'm trying to do now with my channel, there was no real big YouTube explosion out there. There was no way to get this information and to ask people and to understand it. I mean, the only way you could do this before was to hang out in the parking lot and wait for somebody to come out, which is not a good thing to do. So I really honestly didn't know what it was. I thought I would go there and work there for a year or two and then probably just move on from that place. And I wasn't too sure, but I went there and I grabbed a hold of it and I absolutely loved it. I mean, there was long hours, there was all sorts of hardships involved, raising kids and, you know, family life and everything else. And so it was definitely very difficult to do. But the passion was there. Even to this day, when I talk about it, I still get passionate about it. And people will bring up stuff. Oh, did you do this? And it's like, yeah, I did. And I still feel it in my heart, you know. So I definitely haven't let it go by any means.
Ryan, you mentioned that you progressed through the portion of a career in the theme park industry as an associate and then a lead and then a supervisor. Which of those positions did you prefer? Which one did you enjoy the most?
Boy, that's a tough one. Each one had their own perks. It had their own up and down in there. The supervisory role, I was definitely able to control more, which was really great because it was pretty much me calling the shots. And I was really looking out for the rides, the machinery's best interest of what we were going to do to maintain that. In, you know, the balance to keep the equipment up along with keeping it safe every day. It's definitely delicate because people always want to go, we need more uptime, but you can't ever compromise safety to create the uptime. So sometimes you have to disappoint people and put the ride up on the board at the front gate and say, sorry, it's not going to be running today. But honestly, I would think the most companionship I had with that was just at the very bottom as a regular mechanic. That was the best. I had everybody there. We all rallied together. We had the boss at the time, which was not me, but we had a boss to hate, which is a lot of people need that common bond. And it does. It draws everybody together. There's something uniformly that everyone can do. Not that we hated the boss completely, but, you know, it's kind of like the foe of the team.
Right. You worked with a lot of different manufacturers. Did you have a favorite?
Honestly, yeah. I still, the majority of rides I worked on throughout my career, the bulk of it, the time I spent there, was on Vekomas. I took care of both an SLC and a Boomerang at the same time a lot of times. So I really got used to their stuff. And then later on, which it's one thing working on it, and you can always say, well, that was dumb. Why did they do that? From any manufacturer, I don't care who it is. But Vekoma really had that good service and that back end to say, I just approached them quite boldly. I said, this is my problem. And I laid everything out. I gave them pictures and measurements. I say, I don't know what to do. And their people would grab the information and go back in the engineering department and they would come up with a solution and say, here, this is what we need to do. And sometimes it meant getting the parks engineering involved with it and just to confirm, yeah, we want to do that. And then we would move forward on stuff. But Vekoma's support of their equipment and the ability to quickly turn around parts and get things out to us as quick as possible was just the best. And of course, out from there, it's like my second favorite was B&M. And those guys are also right up there on top. They've got also the same thing with their parts. I this was an incredible thing for me one time. I asked them, we had some valves that were failing in a pneumatic flooring assembly. And I said, I needed replacement valves. And they said, well, they don't make those valves anymore. I said, oh. They said, well, we have a solution. You just have to upgrade the whole valve pack to this different thing. And I was like, okay, so they sent me information, a quote, for not only the valves I needed, components to put them together, all the little nipples and fittings and everything, and then they sent me a sheet with the back plane, which is the steel plate that it mounts on, with the back plane information, with the original hole layouts of where everything was put, and then where I had to drill holes to mount this new valve assembly. And it was just like, wow, that was pretty incredible. So I think just because I worked on them so much, Vekoma's at the top for me. And then, but I mean, just a hair away is B&M.
So Ryan, you know, you mentioned Vekoma and B&M as your favorite manufacturers to work on. And it seems like, obviously, like the logistics and how easy they make it for you is the driving factor with that. But do you personally have a ride that was your favorite to work on? I don't want you to dox yourself by saying like the name of the ride, but maybe a model or something like that that was special to you that you rode as a child or anything like that?
I didn't really have anything that was really hit me like that, like because I wasn't going to this park growing up, so it was a relative new experience for me to come into these rides. But one of the things I do have to say is that I was intimately involved with our RMC conversion, where we took an old Woody, a GCI coaster, and converted it to an RMC. And I had my hand in pretty much every aspect of that at the supervisory level. So I could say I put a lot of time and effort into that one. So that one really, like when I talk about it and when I get that passion about it, that's one of those rides, that RMC one, is to say I put so much into that. I went over from California to Texas, and I did the control system there with the engineers. And then I went over and I was overseeing all the motors and control wiring, pneumatics, everything installed throughout, all the way through commissioning, and then the nightmare of opening the thing. I was also present for all of that as well. So that, yeah.
So Ryan, let's talk about one of the favorite topics with coaster enthusiasts, something they love on every single ride: trim brakes. Talk about why they're important.
So trim brakes are quite necessary, and basically what they're doing out on the ride is they are slowing that train back down for a reason. When you get the G-forces, when you get the forces on the train too high on the other side, it's fun for the rider. Riders love it. Don't get me wrong. I do too. So it's absolutely great, but the material in the train and on the track, they're not designed for that constant hammering like that. So they'll take it, they'll do it safely, day in and day out, no problem. But when you let those rides get up really fast, it tends to take its toll on things. After you might start cracking wheel carriers maybe 5 years prematurely instead of getting that extra 5 years of life out of them. So they like to slow it back down and keep the forces on the train, the track, and everything else the same. Along that lines, as that if you were to modify the ride later, put more speed wheels on it, do something like that, and get that speed back up, you might actually cross the boundary, depending on the ride, you might cross the boundary of what the ride was tested under. So when they did the initial testing, the engineers went out and put accelerometers all over it and said, our XYZ axis, our G-forces, are right within the design parameter where we want them. Well, if you speed that up, those G-forces start exceeding the design parameters, which is, again, the equipment will handle it relatively well day in and day out for umpteen years. But what they worry about in that case is they worry about the stress on the rider, because someone like me, I don't care. I enjoy it. It's not a big deal. But someone who meets that minimum height requirement, and the height requirement, you got to remember, is the relative, it's a connection between the bone density and the ride. So people that are younger have a lighter bone density, and that sustained G-force puts too much stress on the body. So realistically, that's the reason height requirements, and they want to make sure that they're not exceeding those parameters that they promised everybody that the ride would operate in. I agree with them, but at the same time, it's way more fun when they don't trim.
Yeah, I agree. They're not very fun. It's like a seatbelt. Like, nobody really wants to have to put on their seatbelt, but they understand the necessity of it. But moving along, Ryan. So you created a YouTube channel, and that's Ryan the Ride Mechanic. Search for him on YouTube. It's one of my favorites as well. What inspired you to do that?
So getting out of the industry, I kind of didn't have anything else to do, but I wasn't ready to let go of it. When I got out of the industry, I had to, the family relocated, our jobs moved to out in Omaha, Nebraska, and I needed to move along with it to make family life better. And there's just no parks out here. There's nothing I could go to. So I had to leave the industry behind, unfortunately. But my heart wasn't ready to leave the industry behind. So I wanted to do something to bridge the gap. And I wasn't sure how to do that. But one thing I picked up on very quickly is that I love talking about rides. I've always liked talking about rides. People can't get me to shut up when I talk about rides. And I said, well, you know what? I could do this. And originally I wanted to start as a podcast, but when I started thinking about it, I had all sorts of examples of stuff I could do, but I couldn't really explain this on a podcast. That, well, a lot of the stuff I do, I end up having to explain it, but I could sit here on camera and start doing this business, but I can still get that message across to people and they understand what I'm talking about when I'm done. So that was what led me to go to the channel.
How did you go about, like, introducing your channel, letting, you know, people know that it was out there?
That was really difficult for me. So I pretty much started making YouTube videos, not knowing anything about it, and not really researching much about it either. And I had all sorts of issues with just the basic stuff. How do I make it? How do I edit it? I put it on there. Why is nobody watching it? And I had to learn everything from the ground up. I say, what's a title? Who cares about the title? What's a thumbnail? What's a thumbnail? It's like, what tags are you using? It's like, sorry, what's a tag? I had to learn everything from the ground up. And then as I started learning about that, I started watching other YouTube creators that their whole job was they made content about making YouTube videos. And I started learning more and learning more. So the channel's grown. I just happened to hit the Fury 325 crack just right on the nose. So the channel took off pretty fast after that. But I do have to say that the group I'm pointing at is quite small. A lot of the people want to talk about rides. They want to talk about how they run, how they feel. They want ratings, best to worst, to top 10, the top 5. But then to have someone come on and say, I want to hear about what actually makes that ride tick. I want to hear the physical mechanics behind it, the cam, how it's greased, what it's put together with. Those people are much fewer and farther between. So it was a difficult process to come up, but I definitely got some acceleration after I just happened to make a video that was suggested by one of my viewers about the Fury 325.
Yeah, it's ironic, Ryan, because I think I found your channel through that video. Now that I'm, because I feel like I've been watching you for a long time, but you haven't been doing this forever. Just several months at this point, right?
Actually, it's like when I look at my oldest videos, it was like it's been 3 years.
Wow.
Now I say that, and people are like, "Whoa, 3 years!" But honestly, before the Fury incident, I failed at one of the key YouTube concepts, which was produce your content, produce it regularly. And whatever it is, if you produce a week, a month, whatever it is, just keep doing that. Well, if you look back at my past videos, I would produce one 3 months later, produce another one a week later, produce one 5 months later, produce one. It was not consistent at all. But people coming on started to push me more into, okay, yes, people are interested, because I was kind of dying off on the channel. And then when the Fury happened, and then a bunch of people suddenly came up and a lot of people expressed interest, it honestly gave me the shot in the arm I needed to actually, right now I've been maintaining this pace of one video per week. And honestly, that's been tough for me to go from like a 5 month between videos to weekly. Yeah. That's been rough.
Well, can you tell us about your Fury 325 video? Like, you don't necessarily have to recap exact. I think most people are familiar with the situation by now, but talk about your coverage of it and why it was unique, especially coming from the perspective of somebody that has been in the industry.
Sure. So how I got there, I was just made a different video, and one of my subscribers said, "Hey, can you make a video on columns?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'll try to support that."
I see what you did there. Good at,
yeah. So then someone else said, "Well, what do you think about Fury 325? And I'm like, "What about Fury 325? I didn't even know about it." And they're like, "Yeah, go check this out real quick." So I went out and found the information. And then I was like, "Oh my gosh, look at that." And then I came back to YouTube and there was already channels that were starting to say, "I hope everyone's okay. I hope no one got hurt. And I'm going to pray and be with people." And it was honestly a knee-jerk reaction from me that was just like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. This was not a life or death thing." Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, it looks bad. Trust me. I mean, it does. It looks bad. But this wasn't something like everyone is in danger. And that's where on the video I made the same comment. I said, "You can take out pretty much every other support and the ride will run just fine. Like, it doesn't care. You may take some life off the back end of it, like the structure may have some more fatigue, but all those pillars are in there basically for the added longevity of the ride. They're not there if like one pillar were to catastrophically fail. The whole thing doesn't just fall over like a cartoon." So my actual knee-jerk reaction for the Fury video was to actually prevent a lot of that. This is a horrible thing that should never happen. It's just like, not really, actually. This stuff kind of happens here and there. Does it happen this bad every time? No, but it's not like it's never, ever happened in the history of the world.
Yeah, I thought you did a great job explaining what happened there when I was watching the video on it. But let's talk about the different things. You talk about knee-jerk reaction, and sometimes, you know, a train may get stopped on a lift for maybe only a few minutes, but it's out there now on YouTube and Facebook and, you know, all the other channels, and it goes viral, and everybody thinks something, you know, went wrong. Talk about those kind of things, like how it's really kind of common. It's almost like an everyday thing. You can't go to any park where some ride does not, you know, at least temporarily stop on a lift hill for whatever reason.
Absolutely. That is, you've probably heard it, a lot of people, especially if you're listening to this, you've heard it 1,000 times before, that the rides are designed to stop. Everything about them is designed to stop. So anytime it stops, that means the ride did its job. And that's what we want the ride to do. From the park where I used to work, I used to bring it up that when we stopped a train on the lift hill, if it was a busy day, we had about 35 minutes of a window to get the people off of that train before the news helicopters started circling. I don't know how they knew about it. They must have been on speed dial or something, because as soon as we got a train over a lift sometimes, got the ride restarted, fired back up, sent the train over, start hearing helicopters, it's like, oh, yep, here comes the news, and they're around looking for a stalled ride on a lift, and it's like, not today. But yeah, it's perception, you know, and it's really bad. Lifts cross pathways, walkways all the time. And people, you got this crowded walkway where everyone's walking underneath and suddenly the thing goes clunk overhead and stops. Well, everyone instantly assumes that it's a horrible thing that just happened. And it's typically just a mismatch of information, some bit of logic in the thousands and thousands of line of code has a one instead of a zero inside of it, and the processor shut it down. That's what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, you talk a lot about preventative maintenance and stuff like that. You've mentioned it here as well as, you know, very extensively on your own channel. But one thing that's always been of interest to me is the daily routines the things that are checked on the rides and stuff like that. Can you brief us on, for your quintessential roller coaster, what the daily routine would be like for checking it and getting it ready for guests in the morning?
Sure. So I'll walk you through a basic inspection, steel roller coaster, because it's pretty easy. So the first thing you do is you lock the ride out because you can't have anything moving while you're out there. And the first thing I always do is go into the infield. And I tell mechanics that are new to the industry, I say you have to look down to look up. So you walk along, you stop, and you look all around, and you want to pay attention to bolted connections and the track and everything else. But really, you want to spend a lot of time combing the ground. You want to look down on the ground, because anything that's come off the train or the track and structure, anything like that, is going to wind up on the ground. Mm-hmm. So my worst case scenario is I walk through an infield in the morning time, and I find a M12 bolt with a Torx stripe on it. And it's just like, uh-oh. M12, which it's a 12-millimeter diameter bolt. A 12-millimeter bolt isn't anywhere on the track and structure. And the fact that it's got a Torx stripe on it means it came off the train. So it's like, okay, I'm looking for something on the top side of the train. Now, it could have been something just as a mechanic such as myself was up there working on something, and we made a replacement on some components, and just one bolt got away. Nobody noticed it, and it was stuck in the panning up on top of the ride. And they sent the ride around, and it flung that bolt off. That's very possible that that happened. There's also possible that, you know, there was a blank hole somewhere, and that just worked its way out. That's more unlikely. Typically, it is a housekeeping issue than anything else. But once we're done with the infield, go back in. Next, I start the lift walk, go up, and I check all the lift stuff, anti-rollback rails, the chain, make sure the chain's lubricated enough, lift motor, sprag, which is typically on most lift motors. And then anything else, the lifts have a lot of evacuation material on there, so catwalks, platforms, railings, things like that, that you have to make sure is ready for use. So you got to make sure that's all like movable, free, and it looks like it could be used at a moment's notice. Once I'm done with the infield, lift, track and structure, I go back to the brakes and I start going through the brakes one by one, open them up and make sure there's plenty of brass thickness left so that the brakes have plenty of that. And then depending on the style brake, I'm listening for air leaks, loose fittings, that sort of stuff down there. And then I get back to the station and or the transfer house. And then I start looking at the train itself. I always start with the wheels, move into the wheel carriers, then into the top of the train, Roth bearings, hitches, beam-to-beam brake supports, safeties. And then after that, we typically move the trains into the station. And once it's in the station, that's when we start looking at the restraints. And the main reason to do it in the station is because the station's flooring already there. So it doesn't matter what ride you're working on. The station is typically the easiest place to work on the restraints of the ride. So then once we've seen nothing's loose, bring the restraints open and close and listen for their ratcheting mechanisms, nice, clean, and free all the way down, number of clicks if you know them. And then at that point, we start cycling the ride. Make the first three. The first two are always, so if you're operating two trains, the first two trains are always a prayer when you send them around. And then when they come back, yay, when they come back, you just start continuing to cycle, listening for the trains as they're out there. Audio is a very big part to the mechanic. And then the last thing you do is you block check. So that involves running the ride typically in special modes and putting the trains in their respective blocks and then purposely trying to crash them into each other. So I do that. It was take one from the station onto the lift. Then I try to crash the train in the station into the lift. Wouldn't let me do it. Okay, block check, good. Station, or the lift to the brakes. Try to crash that from the lift to the brake. Won't let me do it. Okay, brakes to maybe another brake or the second brake. And just keep moving around the ride like that. And then once everything's all checked, give it another cycle or two. Sign it off, it's ready for operations. Amazing. Oh, during that is also the queue line inspection too. Most the safety signage is the most important thing in the queue line. But yeah, that's pretty much a daily.
Do you ever hear from other parks about your videos that you're doing?
I actually have a lot of parks contact me, and it's not in the way most people would think, because I'll be talking about problems and I'll be talking about little issues on rides, and I'll actually have mechanics and sometimes supervisors, managers contact me privately on the email, and they say, hey, we're having this problem. What do you know about this? What do you think about this? And I can give them any insight. I had one mechanic contact me, and he says, we are destroying wheels because our mechanics are taking them apart wrong. Now, what are your thoughts on taking wheels apart? And I explained to him how I took wheels apart. And they're like, that is a great process. I want to teach that to our guys. And I'm like, best way to do it. Go for it.
Absolutely. So, Ryan, do you feel like the fact that you worked in the industry and your history with the industry, like since working there, has it affected your enjoyment of visiting theme parks? Do you have a new perspective? Do you enjoy them more, less? What are your thoughts?
I still enjoy going to amusement parks, absolutely. I would say I enjoy them more because I know where my safety lies, and I can really eyeball rides and say, I could tell if it's being maintained, if it's not being maintained. So I think I enjoy them more now these days, going along and doing this stuff. But it's definitely one of those things. I still don't trust some areas. And if parks give me some red flags, I will kind of like, all right, I start looking down my nose at those red flags there and say, well, you guys didn't do too good on this here. Like, I'm seeing a lot of, and believe me, I'm not nitpicking stuff. I know things happen, but I'm looking at major procedural gaps. And then I'm like, uh-oh, this is a problem. And I had one recently where I was at a local park to hear, and there was a very large procedural gap staring me in the face. And that just caused me to take like three steps back from the park. And then everything I rode on for the rest of the day, I looked at it a little more carefully each time, because like that left a bad taste in my mouth.
Ryan, you did one episode that I thought it was, pretty amusing, but you were like in a conference room. You're all talking about different story ideas and things going around the room. Talk about that a little bit, about how, maybe the PR, team would come to you with an idea or something, and then as you're getting into it, they're trying to walk through and say, no, don't say this, don't say that.
Yeah. So I've done a lot of work with PR and the news and stuff like that. I mean, we had Modern Marvels come through the park, and I got to work with those guys doing some stuff. So I've had my opportunity to do a lot of stuff, and I kind of get the, well, say what you're going to say, but then like the PR department, a lot of times there's like, well, you can't say that. And I'm just sitting there like, well, why can't I say that? It's like, well, we're not supposed to. It's like, but that's common knowledge. Everyone knew that. Well, still, we don't like talking about that. And I'm just like, why don't we want to? Oh, okay, that's fine. But it's kind of odd, the stuff that they don't want you to talk about. One thing that I got in trouble for one time, got a stern talking to about, was I was giving a tour of people. And I said, oh yeah, this is our $16 million floorless coaster. And PR came up to me and I said, you can't tell them it's cost $16 million. And I'm like, that's common knowledge. I actually got that number from the internet of all places. But the director confirmed, he's like, yeah, about $16 million. I was like, okay. But for some reason, PR really didn't want that. But one of the things, when you get away from just having fun at the park and we're having a good time and we're just talking about stuff, and you start stepping backwards, well, you got to remember, this information can surface everywhere throughout, anywhere. They can find this information. So if you say, we did this, well, if you ever get in a lawsuit about it, those lawyers can find that information. And then they can dangle it right back over your head and say, well, you said this. Was this not correct? Like, what? And they can take everything and spin it back at you. So it's a great thing plenty of parks in other countries over there in Germany. I've seen a couple parks do this where they hold videos of all their back lot stuff, for all their maintenance procedures and everything. They go along with them, and that's just awesome. And I have a lot of people from other countries ask me, well, why can't you do that in the U.S.? And I'm like, well, our country's kind of lawyer dominated. You know, everything here, especially out in California where I was, you blink the wrong way, you're going to get sued. You're in a lawsuit before you know it. And it's sad, but even engineers, it's not a question of if you're sued, it's when you're sued. And that's just such a bad thing about it. You know, that's kind of the downside of the whole thing. There are people, they just want money. You know, it's so bad. But one of the first fronts of preventing that is simply not putting the information out there. So PR, honestly, is kind of the front line for making sure it's the good stuff going forward. Sometimes a little too good, and you don't get anything out of it. You don't get the, oh, yes, we work on the rides every single day. And it's like, yeah, okay. But sometimes people want to know more, and they're like, oh, well, we don't want to discuss that. Well, why? Why don't you want to discuss that? And it's hard to honestly break down that barrier. Most parks just don't want to let people in their inner workings.
Yeah, Ryan, when I was doing PR for a park, that was one of my favorite things, was to get with the maintenance team and show the work that they do, you know, both during the winter months, you know, when they're tearing down the trains every last, you know, stripping it down to every last bolt and nut, to the morning maintenance checks. And they made fascinating stories. And I think in a lot of ways that helped the guest feel better when they came to the park, knowing that all of this kind of work was going on.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely two ways to look at it. There's that way, which I prefer, and that's your method too, which sounds like you prefer, which is awesome. And I wish everyone was like that. But then there is like that video where I was kind of pointing fun at it. There is the opposite side where it's like,
right,
we check the wear on the brake brass every single day on those brakes. And then other people are standing there going, oh, you mean the brakes are worn down? And it's like, well, and then once you put that information out, you can't that information. But, you know, people then grab that and they start going to all the different platforms and saying, well, their stuff is worn down. It's like, we check for cracks and their stuff is cracked. This is amazing. It's like, well, how is that park even open? So I see both sides of the coin, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, as much as I like to talk about lawsuits, let's talk about my second favorite thing, Dollywood. So recently, Dollywood with Lightning Rod, the launched RMC coaster, replaced the launched lift hill with a regular high-speed chain lift hill. In your experience, do launched rides have more downtime than traditional lift hill rides? And if so, why do you think that's true?
So there's a curve to this for sure. The newer the technology is, the less downtime there is. Now, I've seen rides like Maverick out there, I believe it's at Cedar Point, mm-hmm. where it's essentially an accelerated lift hill, and the thing works flawlessly. And I do have to say, Intamin did a awesome job with their whole magnetic propulsion systems. They have come leaps and bounds, and they have really driven the industry around that way. But when it comes to that, I mean, it's kind of like, well, which way do you want to go? Are you worried about power consumption? Because then you might not want to go with magnetic. It might be less power simply just to run a chain lift the entire time. Wearables, it's like, well, you can line the lift hill with stators, and each one of those stators, which is roughly 3 feet long, just a little bit over that, each one of those stators costs about $14,000. So you figure you have 400 feet of lift hill to cover. That's a lot of money in stators sitting there. And the chains are tried and true. They're proven. You have lift motor or gearbox. I mean, you could pretty much buy the whole setup three times over for what it would cost for a synchronous system to go in its place. But you're talking less wear and tear on a synchronous system because there is no liner to replace. You don't have to replace the chain every 5 years. Eventually the stators will wear out, but that's way far down the road. So I think where we're at right now, I think for the majority of stuff, chain lift hills are still going to be the standard. And the power-driven lifts will probably make their way into the market much more as the size of trains come down. As because, you know, like a Maverick and those rides, they run smaller trains through them. So they're able to, the system's able to handle that weight at that angle and accelerate it. But it is energy consumption, and a lot of parks right now have a Go Green initiative where they are looking for power savings. You know, the grid's overworked as it is. Everyone's trying to go to electric cars, which is stressing the system out even more. And then here's this amusement park that is just throwing out electricity on these launch rides. So although they still want to do that, and people love it, I love it too, but eventually the Go Green initiatives are going to start looking at that power consumption versus what it's doing. So that's a very interesting little topic there. I would have preferred to see, honestly, for Lightning Rod, I would have preferred to see the LSM system simply replaced with a different LSM system. Honestly think, this, I made a video on this one too. I honestly think if they had contracted someone like Intamin to come in and just replace the drive system for that ride, I think it would have done just fine.
Yeah, Ryan, let's talk about, when a park installs a ride. How often is the manufacturer still involved after the installation?
So when you install a ride, the manufacturer has liability of the ride because that is their equipment. And that's the reason you maintain a ride with the manual from the manufacturer to that ride's the manual, is because you're trying to get the manufacturer to maintain that liability throughout the ride's lifetime. So as long as you maintain it to the manual, the way the manufacturer told you to maintain it, as long as you do that and you buy parts from the manufacturer, and if there's a problem, you go back to them, they pretty much have liability and control of that ride throughout its entire life. Now, if you want to buy the ride from a manufacturer and then you want to tell them to hit the bricks and you want to do your own thing, you can do that. But then if there's a crack, if there's a failure, or heaven forbid, there's a catastrophic failure of some type, then all the liability goes back to the park. It goes back to the engineering team that said, yes, let's take control of this on our own. So realistically, the manufacturer is involved with that ride the entire time, throughout its entire life. And then every park is that manufacturer's opportunity to improve, because they build rides and they put these widgets on it, and then the things start failing. Well, they know to stop putting those on future rides. And then other parks where they have these widgets fail in this particular way, they start noticing a trend and saying, well, what's going on? What's happening? And then they find out they're side loading and it's causing these little failures. And then they could put service bulletins out to the other parks that still use them and say, oh, hey, by the way, look for side loading in this area and you'll prevent failures for it. So it's quite critical that the manufacturer stay involved with the ride as much as possible. Don't want to cut them out of the picture for sure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Ryan, a wise man once said, grease is the blood of rides. And that also happens to be a recent episode of Ryan the Ride Mechanic. Can you brief us on that, your thought process with that?
Sure. So grease is the blood of rides. Without grease and without lubrication in rides, they will literally chew themselves apart. And they won't last at all. And you're not just talking about, oh, I have to replace a bearing or two. The bearing will seize onto the shaft, destroy the shaft. The shaft will bite into the chassis. You'll be replacing entire parts of the ride, not just a bearing or two. So it's critical to keep those things greasy, happy, and then, well, to prevent guests from getting grease on them, you don't want to keep them too greasy. So like I said, good mechanics always carry rags around with them as well. But it was kind of funny because when Modern Marvels came through our park, they were doing an episode on grease. And they asked me all sorts of questions. I gave them all sorts of answers and blah, 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 blah. And I just gave them everything I could possibly think of. And the one part that made it into the episode was me doing, like, greasing the rail tracks where the ride was. And I'm just like, yeah, it helps the wheels slide back. And that was like it. It's funny. Like 10 hours that day, and they got that one little part from me where I'm just like, ooh. So, yeah, but I mean, it's not only necessary for the life of the roller coaster, but I mean, just maintaining all of your components, the wear and tear. If you don't grease them and keep them lubricated properly, they will tear themselves apart quick, really quick. And your wheels are the first ones to show that. So if you don't keep the track lubricated enough, you'll start cupping wheels, and then you're replacing, you know, people don't realize how many wheels are on a roller coaster. And then you suddenly you're up to like 90, 100, 150 wheels needing replacing. It happens quick. So.
You know, Ryan, talk about the challenges between maintaining a wooden coaster versus a steel coaster.
So wooden coasters are really interesting. They are their own creatures, essentially, because wood is alive. Best way to describe it. Wood's alive. So on top of just having the structure with bolted connections and everything else, you have a whole nother element to wood roller coasters. You actually have to keep the track in the right state of hydrated, because it's just like a person. When it gets really hot outside, it loses the water. So you need to put more water on it. Literally at nighttime, we would water the wood roller coasters because they needed that to get on the wood so the wood can maintain that hydration. When the wood loses its hydration, it shrinks. Well, when it shrinks, all the connections come loose, everything. And then as soon as you loosen a connection on a wood roller coaster, the boards start to rattle, and next thing you know, they snap. And you start breaking hardware, you start breaking boards, everything. It's really bad. So if there's ever a problem on a wood roller coaster where it starts really just tearing up the track in certain areas, one of the first things to do is to simply water the wood and to put the hydration back into it. And then it comes back. Not to mention that hammering effect that you feel starts to smooth out, because as that wood becomes hydrated, the wood's able to flex more. And it's able to get that give back into the structure where the train starts to smooth out over it. As much as a wooden roller coaster can be smooth, because wood does flex a lot. Most of that rattling is simply the train jumping from bent to bent as it goes around the track. But the wooden roller coasters, it's mainly all about that track. And then if you underhydrate it, and then you have your team go around and tighten all the hardware because everything's loose, and then you hydrate it again, then you start snapping hardware everywhere because the wood tried to swell up but can't because it couldn't go anywhere.
Now, Ryan, there's two mainstream types of restraints nowadays. You've got ratcheting and hydraulic. Can you compare and contrast your opinion on the two from a mechanical standpoint?
Sure. I prefer hydraulic, but that's just because it has such a... There's no click to be had. Ratchets, I feel they're definitely awesome. They're cheap. They're easy to maintain. But when you're talking about rider comfort, to get that restraint down right on top of somebody, no more, no less, that's really worth it right there. Because a lot of people have this trouble where they get into a ride and they're trying to get it down, and they get it down and you're like maybe smaller, and there's a lot of room between you and that restraint. And then you get it down, some people, where they get down that last click and they're basically pinned in the thing. So I feel it's much more of creature comfort to use the hydraulic restraints out there. And they're just much more simpler to deal with. I mean, you put 24 bolts to it and it unlocks. And you got two of them there, one for redundancy. The RMC I worked on, we did a special control system deal there where it checked the opposite restraint every single cycle. So you would come in, and when they told the restraints to lock, it was actually only locking one of the two cylinders. So one cylinder would lock while the other one was unlocked. And when they came around and checked your restraints, they were simply checking the one cylinder on there. But what they were doing is that they were saying that if one of them failed for some reason, you would find that cylinder bare minimum in two cycles. Because they would go to lock it and it would go down. And then as they pull up on that, it would start to give. It would feel really spongy and start to squish. and the operators would be like, "What's no? Something's wrong here," and they would stop operation. And we had that demonstrated several times, where it's like, "Okay, look, we found it." Middle of the day, other rides, older rides that use hydraulic restraints, you wouldn't find it till the next day, when you went to do the cylinder check in the morning time. So the systems have become very fail-safe, very redundant. And I mean, when you look at the amount of time needed to maintain a hydraulic system, it's nothing compared to the older ratchet style system. So I much rather prefer the hydraulics these days on everything.
So Ryan, if someone had an interest in becoming a ride mechanic, what advice could you give them on what's the best path to go about that?
The advice I give people when it comes to that is simply just go talk with your park, put your resume in and see what they say. It's one of those things. I'm like, there's no school. People say, what do I need for schooling? Do I need a degree? Do I need this or that? And I always tell them, say, no, the park is looking for someone that's willing to learn, and the park is looking for someone that is passionate about the job. If you find somebody that's passionate and willing to learn, I will take that person. I personally hire that person any day over anybody else. If you came up and say, well, I have all these degrees and I have all this background and knowledge of automation, all this stuff, but I don't want to be here. Well, it's like, oh, well, that doesn't work for me. And then you find someone that's like, I don't know anything about it, but I really like this stuff. I spend all my time. I go to amusement parks constantly. I really want to learn about this, but I just don't know anything about it. I look at that person and say, we will teach you. Come on in. That's how I do that. So if anybody wanted to do stuff to prep for it, industrial automation, industrial machinery is about the closest you can come to working on rides. It's essentially a giant conveyor system with a free run track attached to it.
Absolutely. Now, Ryan, just one more time before we let you go. Can you tell us where to find you? Do you have social media for Ryan the Ride Mechanic, or are you just on YouTube right now?
My YouTube is really where everything's at. I'm on YouTube at Ryan the Ride Mechanic. I do have Instagram. I honestly don't do too much through it, but that's also Ryan the Ride Mechanic. If people wanted to contact me, you could contact me at email. It's RyanTheRideMechanic@yahoo.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. This has really been enlightening. So I can personally testify, one of my favorite channels. You know, if you want to know about the nitty gritty stuff, whether it's the everyday mundane stuff that we kind of talked about with the daily checks and so on, all the way up to things like the Fury Crack, you know, this is the guy to listen to. So search for Ryan the Ride Mechanic on YouTube for more information. But we'll have to have you back on again. This has been fantastic.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Stick around. We got the pick six coming up next.